Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I am Michael Steele. It's always a pleasure when you come into the house and get to kick back a little bit as we have great conversation. I always love it when you do it. Don't forget to do that download thing. You know, we love it when you download. It makes me feel all yummy inside. So this is a special treat for me in this conversation. So let me tell you a little bit about the brother we're going to have some fun with this afternoon. He is the author of the New York Times bestsellers, Bobby Kennedy, A Raging Spirit, Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero, Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Work, Kennedy and Nixon, and Hardball. Hint, hint. He mounted a campaign for Congress as a Democratic maverick running against Philadelphia's old political machine. He was later a speechwriter for President Carter, chief of staff to legendary Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill. And then he decided to flip the game completely and become a columnist and reporter, which led to his work with the San Francisco Examiner and a number of other publications, winding him up on television, where we got to spend the next 20 years watching him, listening to him, learning him, and playing hardball with none other than Chris Matthews. Let's play hardball. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Mike. It's good to be on.
Man, it's so much fun to have you. I've been waiting for this book because you and I have talked about it a little bit offline as you were kind of going through the process to sort of share a side of you that a lot of people probably don't know. That's not just the TV personality, but a little bit of what I laid out there, the guy who has been in the thick of politics for a long time, who understands the personalities of it and the whims and the wiles of it. What is it about this new book, which is, folks, it's a great title, This Country, My Life in Politics and History. It's out this month. What is it about this book that's different from the others for you?
Well, I think the big picture, the big story here is I'm a guy who grew up as a kid fascinated with politics, and I was looking at it from the outside. And all the way through my time in the Peace Corps in Africa, I was looking at it from the outside. I'd sit over there reading whatever little literature I could get, including the Voice of America, to try to figure out who's going to win the Senate races in the United States in 1970. I was actually right, but only because my mistakes offset each other, which often happens with my predictions. Like when I predicted the 88 election right on the nail, and I predicted the 90 congressional elections on the nail. I've been shrewd, but also lucky. And then I came back and I got a job on the Hill as a cop, Capitol Hill policeman, which has become pretty resonant.
Yeah, that's something a lot of people don't know, that you're a Capitol Hill policeman.
But let's not oversell it. I was a patronage guy like Harry Reid was, Michael Barnicle were. Right. I didn't have any connections. I did it so I could work in a senator's office in the morning by getting paid to be a cop in the afternoon. So I was double shifting. I was moonlighting. And I did that for 3 or 4 months. But I did learn a lot from these conservative white guys from West Virginia.
Right.
These guys I wouldn't have met. Probably Trumpers. But very loyal to their job. One guy said to me, I've died for this building, even though if I wouldn't die for that riverboat down the street in the White House. I never thought of it as a riverboat, but maybe it looks like one. And, you know, when they taught me a lot about their sense of being displaced, these guys, you know, and their patriotism of the crudest kind, maybe you might say, because one of the guys pulled me aside. His name's Leroy Taylor. He was a real former MP type. I mean, he really was an MP. And he saw me as the college kid, and he called me aside one time and said, you know why the little man loves his country? And I said, no. He said, because it's always God.
Yeah.
And it was one of those lines like, did you remember?
Yeah.
And that's one thing I learned from that job, that I became a Senate legislative assistant. What I always wanted to be from the time I was thinking about these things, first of all, I was in a PhD program in economics at Chapel Hill, UNC, which I hated. I was managing to get A's by memorizing whole sheets of blue books. I mean, I knew how to memorize like a photographer, but I had no idea what I was photographing. I didn't get it. I don't get economics. And then I gave up on that. I went back to Chapel Hill after I got out of the Peace Corps in Africa. And I said, I'm not going back. I'm not coming back. I went to the Hill, knocked on doors, got that first job, worked my way up, finally became 10 years later, top aide to the Speaker of the House, got to work with Tip O'Neill, as you said, the legendary Tip O'Neill, in the back room every day.
Yeah.
Just him and me and Kirk O'Donnell and Ari Weiss, and nobody else got in the room. He wouldn't let anybody else in the room when he was conniving with us. He didn't want everybody to know that he had help.
Just how devious he was.
Yeah, well, he would tell me about Curly. Remember James Michael Curly?
Yeah.
The old Irish thief from Boston. He was the role model for the last hurrah. I asked him about him one time, Mr. Speaker. I said, what was Curly like? He said he was a crook. He said he was crooked by the standards of those days. That's how crooked he was. And I said, was he a crooked person? He said, personally. But then he would tell me these stories like Curly, he broke with Curly at one point, and pardon the ethnic reference here because it's old school talk, but he said, Curly said to him, I'll run a Chinaman against him, beat you. And he did. He got a Chinese American foul, put him on the ballot, and Tip killed the guy. But then Curly, being a crook, transposed the numbers so the Chinese guy destroyed Tip in his own district. The guy, nobody had ever heard of the guy, and the people pick up the papers and say, some Chinese guy has just swamped Tip O'Neill, the local guy. And Tip knew that, and Curly knew, that Tip would never go to the U.S. attorney over it because you don't challenge party leaders in your own primary. You didn't do it in those days.
Interesting.
But Curly knew he could get away with it by that ridiculous little joke of his. I guess the Chinese fellow felt, the Chinese American guy felt good for a while. Tip O'Neill by
15 minutes of fame.
Yeah, but that was the kind of rascal he was. And Tip figured him out. But he finally got his own. Tip was not a Kennedy guy. He was a John McCormick guy. There's always that rivalry up there. And then I got to cover things like the Berlin Wall coming down. And I'm there talking to the East Germans, the people under communist, you and I share that view.
Yeah.
I said, what is freedom? Was ist Freiheit? I said to some young guy, he said, talking to you. And this a nurse came up to us, and this is the rain's coming down. It's from the eastern side of the Brandenburg Gate. They're waiting for the Brandenburg Gate to open up. And she said, 3 weeks ago, we couldn't talk. We couldn't talk about whether we wanted socialism or we wanted capitalism. We couldn't talk in public politics in any way. And then I was in, who else gets to go vote with Bishop Tutu? I was down with Archbishop Tutu.
Right.
The first day, they had the all races election in South Africa, thanks to Nelson Mandela, who wouldn't get out of prison. He wouldn't come out after 20 years unless they legalized his party. He said, we're going to have a real election. I'm not coming out. Imagine that after 20 years without seeing your wife, without seeing anybody. 28 years in a cell, 8x10 or something. And he said, I'm not coming out until you let everybody vote.
And that's amazing.
And that day I saw, there's a picture in the book of a voting line from one horizon to another horizon. And I'm with Bishop Tutu. And he went back to his residence and we talked all morning about, he told me all about growing up under apartheid, what it was like and how embarrassing it was to him, and he has to tell his daughter she can't get on the kids because it's a white kid swing.
Yeah.
And all this lot like Jim Crow. But maybe more horrendous, if it is possibly more horrendous, because the population in South Africa had gone from like 3/4 black to like 7/8 black. The whites were a very small minority and they were calling the shots.
Yeah.
They had the guns.
And, yeah.
Simple as that, raw power. And they gave it up, thanks God, to F.W. de Klerk. He was like Gorbachev. He said, I'm giving it up. I'm giving it to Mandela. He's going to be the next president. So there's a certain nobility to that. And I was impressed.
But
without a shot being fired, they changed from white rule to black rule, majority rule, without a shot being fired. It was pretty, and that's because Nelson Mandela said, this is how we're going to do it, through voting.
You've been, through your professional and certainly your academic work, and certainly the work you did with the Peace Corps, you've been on the front lines of a lot of historic moments, and sort of seen them up close and personal. What did you try to catch? I mean, this country, your new book, My Life in Politics and History, you talk about it through your perspective, but was this sort of your way of kind of sort of stepping back and going, damn, have I been in the moment or have I been in the moment? You know, how lucky and blessed am I to have been in this life, in this history at these times?
Well, I'm a little bit of Zelig. Remember the Woody Allen movie years ago? I'm a little bit of Forrest Gump. They will Photoshop these pictures of him talking to everybody in history. But, you know, I did, you said a few moments ago, I knew a lot of guys. I got to spend a little quiet time with, Bill Clinton, yeah. With Hillary Clinton, with Barack Obama, with George W. Bush. I got to make a little, you know, I got a sense of their jib, who they are to be with, what they're like to be with. Almost universally, they're all better in person than they are on the stage.
Yeah,
you know that. They're just when they're not.
They just are.
Off,
they just are.
They're not showing off when they're just charming you.
Yeah,
even Bibi Netanyahu could be charming. He gave an hour to me and my wife.
Hey, look, let me tell you my Bill Clinton story. Just to your very point,
I love the insides. Yeah.
Bill. So first time I get to meet Bill Clinton, I'm Lieutenant Governor of Maryland. And there was an event that I was invited to with the president. And I said, yeah, sure, I'll go. And so I went. And of course, this is, you know, probably about 2003, 2004. So he's been out of office for a few years. And I get in the room and I walk up to him, wait in the line, walk up to him. And I go to shake his hand. And he goes, Michael Steele, how are you? Excuse me. Anyways, he says, Lieutenant Governor, such a pleasure to meet you. I've wanted to meet you for a long time. It's such a pleasure. And he started talking as if we had been like at the clubhouse the other day for brewskis. It's just an amazing charm, obviously, but just a level of connection that to your point, you know, you see these guys on the formal stage and they're sort of doing the audience thing. But that one-on-one conversation sometimes, which you've been privy to a lot, is something very different. And I'll never forget stories when we were at MS and you were getting ready for a show one day. And we were kind of talking about Tip O'Neill and Reagan. And you relayed the story of Reagan and Tip and you being in the room and you kind of spoke a little bit out of turn. You were like doing the sort of partisan thing, sort of reminding the president that, you know, this
well,
is
yeah, really- that's what I, when he came into the, the president of the United States gives the State of the Union address to the Congress outside of the Capitol. And they used to use this as his green room, his holding room, the speaker's ceremonial office right next to my office. So I, in my usual character, personality, go banging through the door in to see him. And he's in there getting ready to give the State of the Union, the first one. And I just come barging into the room and I say, Mr. President, welcome to the room where we plot against you.
Yes.
And then he goes, oh, no, not under six. The speaker says, in this city, we're all friends after six.
That's right. That's right.
And then I was really good at that, Michael. I got to tell you the story. George Herbert Walker Bush, no surprise. What a gentleman. He, when he was elected and he's taking office, he's president for a few months, I got invited to one of those nights he was having everybody over for movies. And it was Bill White, the former head of one of the baseball leagues, mm-hmm. and commissioner, and Marty Russo and Tom Foley, an interesting group of pretty bipartisan, interesting group of people. And the guy he had up for Secretary of Defense from Texas, I forget his name for a minute. The guy that was killed in the plane accident later.
Anyway,
so we're all hanging around, and he comes over to my dad, who I managed to get in because my mom was beginning to have Alzheimer's, and they let me bring her. He made a comment about our family being Democrats. I said, Mr. President, I'm the only Democrat in the family. Everybody's Republican. So he said, what happened to you? And I go, okay. So and then about 3 months later, we're in the Roosevelt room, right in the West Wing. And we're having a meeting of the Hearst reporters, all of us in the Hearst Bureau. And I was working for Hearst, which owned the San Francisco Examiner. And I thought he'd forgotten me. I mean, I didn't even know why he invited me in the first place.
Except right.
He saw me on CBS Morning News. But he comes all the way down around that long table, you know, all the way around, mm-hmm. makes a left turn, comes all the way over to me and looks me in the eye and says, has your father changed your mind about things?
I love it. I love it.
And they're men and women with that gift.
Yep.
Clinton's got it. Tip O'Neill had it. George Sr. I think George W. had it, his son.
Yep.
Remember not just your name and your face, but remembering something about you, maybe your kids, maybe who's sick in the family. My God, it's a gift. Jimmy Carter, on the other hand, didn't have that gift.
Right.
And he was a good man. And I was very proud to work for him. He's clean as a whistle. But I'm on Air Force One the week before we lost in 1980. And I'm walking past his cabin in the old Air Force One, the old.
Right.
And I look in, and there's a mugshot book, big binder with plastic covers for each of the pages, transparent. And they're all the pictures of the mayors and the people he's meeting at the next stop.
Wow. Can you
imagine how sad that is?
Wow.
You're freaking president of the United States, and your real job in those hours and days is to try to familiarize yourself with the faces, if you can tell a face from a picture or picture from a face, whatever. And he had him so that when he gets off that plane, he doesn't have somebody saying, "You don't even remember my name."
Right, right.
He had to remember like 7 or 8 or 10 people waiting in line. He's got to remember everybody's face and connect it with a name, or else that person won't work for him anymore. They'll say, "Yeah, I work for him, but he doesn't even remember who I am." And
right, right.
But the gifted pals of both parties, and maybe you can do this, can remember everybody. And that's, I don't have that gift. My wife drives me crazy. She said, "I have this dumb look on my face when I meet people." Like, "Do I know you?" In fact, I even say, "Do I know you?" And she goes crazy. You can't.
Look, I look for my wife to save me sometimes, because it does become a blur at a certain point. And every once in a while, my wife will go, "Oh, that's John. Oh, thanks, John. Yeah, hey, John, how's it going?" You know,
especially on TV, Michael, because you're on, you know, people, they know you from entirely from TV, and you've never met them. But they, if you meet them twice, they say, "Well, he sees me. He's seen me twice." They've seen. And, you know, you just have to fake it. You just got to fake it. And the Kennedys all, they used to call everybody, "Hey, buddy."
Or, yeah. "Hey, everybody pal." Didn't know who they were.
No, they didn't know who you were.
So, well, so what is it? What is it about this country that you want to say in this book? What is it? Not just your own story, but about this country. You wrote a piece in the beginning of May, talking about the Biden administration, and it was entitled, it was in the Washington Monthly, "What Joe Biden Learned from Ronald Reagan About Governing." And you note that, you know, if he owes any predecessor for the 59% job approval he had at that time, it's the chief executive who defeated and succeeded Carter, Ronald Reagan. The elements of Biden's governing politics match up with the Reagan style of approach. You know, number one, honor your partisan base; two, focus; three, audacity; four, speed. What is it that you see in the leadership of this country under Joe Biden that is reminiscent of 1981 Reagan? And how does that help us navigate what is some pretty rough waters right now?
Well, they're rough and still are. Maybe they're getting rougher. I think you have to remember the broadest possible reason you're elected and lead with that when you get into office. What was it that most people voted for? What was the reason? So with Reagan, it was get the economy back on shape, deal with the high interest rates, the high inflation, show some strength internationally, of course. Mm-hmm. Try to be un-Carter. And so he, when he came into office, thanks to his chief of staff, James Baker, they focused entirely on a big tax cut. They focused eventually on beefing up defense, all that within a few months. So they really hit the buttons that got them elected. They danced with the one that brung you. As we mm-hmm. said. And with Biden, I call him O'Biden by accident, because he's always pushing the Irish thing. You know, he's always talking about Grandpa Finnegan and all.
Finnegan, right.
It's malarkey. It's so schmaltzy, but he does it. He knew that he had to get his handle around COVID. He had to fix that. And I think he's still wrestling with it. He trying to get the 70% coverage of people with the shots.
Right.
He lucked out because the shots were available right away after January 20th. So he did lead with the COVID relief, and he got the bill through reconciliation, a lot of money for COVID relief for people, keep money in people's pockets. So that's his second goal, was to try to refix the economy after COVID. He's struggling with that. But there's so many other things he's promised. Now, his problem now is that his honeymoon's over.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the Republicans have decided that they can beat him in 2022. They can beat Pelosi. They can maybe take the Senate. And they can do it running a negative campaign against the way things are. And the way things are still, high unemployment. And they can blame that on too many dollars being spent on unemployment comp.
Right.
And the border's not under control, and we're going to have inflation, and there's probably going to be higher crime. So he's got to, what I think Mitch McConnell's up to as the Republican leader, is make sure Biden doesn't get any more scores, no more victories. That's it. And with Joe Manchin and Sinema in Arizona, there's not 50 votes plus the vice president.
How does he handle that?
There. I don't know. I know when I worked for Tip, we played hardball. When Bob Michael was the Republican leader, was opposing our infrastructure bill, which wasn't much of a bill. It was a political thing pretty much, but it was a big jobs bill right before the 1982 election. So I went to Peoria. I went to the chief engineer of Peoria, and I got a list of all the bridges below safety code. And the speaker got on the House floor. He came down from the chair and went down to the well and listed the names and addresses of those bridges in Bob Michael's district that were below safety code.
That's what I'm talking about.
Well, that's
how you do it. That's hardball, baby.
And nobody's done that this time. They talk about infrastructure. It's a Latinate word. It's a boring word. It's a really boring word. And they haven't put the feet to the fire of the people who are holding out. They should say, look, Joe Manchin, you're defending this rickety bridge the school bus has to go over this afternoon. You look at these potholes. Those are yours, Joe. Those are your potholes because you can have this. Bobby Byrd, as you know well, represented West Virginia for years. Mr. Pork Barrel.
Yes.
He moved
total.
Half the federal government out there. He had no shame in moving every building, intelligence community facilities, anything he could get that would bring jobs to West Virginia, a poor state. And I just bumped into him at the Cafe Milano the other night in Washington, Joe Manchin. He's representing his state, that's his case. But the state may have a cultural opposition to liberals or to any kind of demographic change.
But they want this infrastructure.
They need to develop. I mean, I just saw that Mississippi, another hellish example, has the lowest vaccination rate in the country.
Yeah.
These countries would rather be white ruled, if you will, and conservative than develop. They seem to be making these decisions. We don't want to develop if it means modernity, if it means modern life.
Which is, to me, it is the most amazing thing in the world when you stop and look at those states around you where the progress is being made on the COVID front. You know, infrastructure dollars are going to be happily accepted. We'll take yours, West Virginia, over here in Maryland. You don't want them. We'll take them.
Yeah.
But the reality of it is for the Democrats, and I've heard you speak to this on a number of appearances in talking about your book, This Country, they feel politics. They don't do politics. So they get all emotional about the stuff, yeah, as opposed to doing the game, playing the game, doing, you know, because here's the reality. You know this as long as you've known Mitch McConnell. If the shoe were on the other foot and the script was that a Republican president with a 50-50 Senate, where they had the majority because of the vice president, and there were big legislation that Republican president wanted to get done, whether it was Supreme Court nominations or an infrastructure bill, you don't think McConnell would blow that filibuster up to do it? Of course he would.
Already. They did it before.
They did it before. So what do Democrats see that the rest of us don't, that keeps them mired?
It's a parliamentary system. I mean, it's like you can't count on everybody in your party most of the time agreeing on the really tough stuff. You know, right now there's 21 states, I count them, where they're ruby red. They're just not going to ever have a Democratic senator in years. It's not going to happen. And so they're Democrats are never in our lifetime probably going to get 60 votes in the Senate. It's just factual.
Right.
The Constitution, for all kinds of reasons, was tilted towards small states, rural states, conservative states. And that's why Idaho has two senators and California has two senators and New York has two senators.
Right.
It's to balance off the power of the big cities. That goes back to probably the Paris communes, that whole notion of the cities shouldn't rule the society.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right.
And
right.
I think that's why all these capitals are in places like Albany and Harrisburg and places like, name it where it is in Missouri. Nobody knows where it is. I mean, it's like,
why is the state capital in the middle of a cornfield?
Or Montpelier. Montpelier, right. Vermont. You can wink as you drive through the, or blink and drive through the woods, and you see, oh, there's the state capitol. Because they don't want the cities, they don't want Burlington calling the shots. So, you know, I think you got to figure out what you're going to do about it. But, you know, I don't know. I was thinking the other night, I was at dinner with somebody who was a lobbyist. I said, you know, maybe what Biden needs is 10 or 20 lobbyists of both parties as a rump group sitting down and figuring out how you make deals with people who are recalcitrant.
Yeah.
What is it they want? If they, because they're always trying to figure out the what's going on in the inside of these people, how they can get to them. And sometimes in the worst way, they'll get to them with something they're afraid of or something. God knows what it is. They'll get them. Find out a way to reach people with what they want and what they need at home. What does Joe Manchin need to deliver before the next election?
Right.
What does he preciously need?
That's old school politics.
Yeah.
That's, well, that's what we used to do.
LBJ, if he could get within three votes, he'd win it.
Right.
Yeah. If you can get within three votes, you can usually find ways to reach. Remember Johnny Bro from Louisiana?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Senator Bro. Yeah.
Quota.
Yeah.
He came out afterwards. He said, I can't be bought, but I can be rented. And it didn't bother the Louisiana voters one bit.
Not one bit. Look, it's where you see some of the folks recognizing, and now there's a lot of discussion around bringing back, you know,
earmarks.
Earmarks. And I was like, why did you get rid of it in the first place? Because that's how you manage the body politic. That's how the leaders, minority and majority, manage the brood, right? And everybody understood it. You know, at like Reagan said, 6 o'clock, there's a bar, there's a restaurant, there's a club somewhere where Republican and Democrat are sitting down and they're talking about how they're going to work the pie the next day. All right. That was part of the game. That was part of the process. Is what I grew up as a native Washingtonian, and having that experience. And one of the things that I find so disheartening now that all of that's gone. It is a zero sum game right now. And
let me tell you something you don't know, Michael, because this went on the inside. Ross Dinkowski, one tough chairman of the Ways and Means Committee from Chicago.
Right.
He got into trouble later for something else, but his way of dealing with people like Charlie Rangel and the rest of them on that committee was this. He would have a thing called a chairman's mark where his staff and he would write a big tax bill. And it may have some good elements in it and some bad elements, but whatever. He would take that mark, the chairman's mark, to every Democrat and Republican on his committee. And he'd get them to say yes, yay, to that mark. Why? Because the second stage of writing up a tax bill were something called the transition rules.
Uh-huh.
Transition rules decide when a tax increase goes into effect, when a tax decrease, a tax cut goes into effect, which can mean millions, if not billions of dollars to corporations in each state, in each district. So he would say, okay, we'll take something in New Haven or someplace in Hartford, an insurance business, say, or let's say the meatpacking industry somewhere in Kansas City or somewhere. And he'd say, okay, that tax cut goes into effect either October 1 of this year or January 1st of next year, a quarter, 3 month difference. Huge amounts of money.
Oh, that's a lot of money.
And he could say, when would you, now I would like you to tell me what you need. But after he's got their support for the bill.
Exactly.
So he had them corralled up. So then he could decide when to reward, when not to reward.
Why don't leaders know how to work?
That was one of the old tricks.
Why do you think leaders don't appreciate or even know how to work it anymore? How to work their members? Is it the fact that they don't have leverage like they may have had before? Is it because earmarks were taken out? Is it because they don't have that Ross Dinkowski kind of, or Tip O'Neill? Kind of like, okay, let's, ready to get in your face.
Okay, Michael, what's the worst thing about running for office? You know what it is. You know what it is. It's fundraising.
It's, you know, raising money every day.
Your 24/7 kissing booth, where you have to be on the phone telling people how brilliant they are. Oh my God. Oh, that's a great idea. I completely am with you.
Right.
I think that's brilliant. You have to, and they're all doing it all. They're over in that room in the RNC room, the Republican committee.
Oh, yeah.
Or then,
oh,
the,
yeah,
Democrats, and they have that the call time room. So, yep, your first year in politics, the first January, your managers, your staff people, haul you over there.
Yes,
and
they do.
And you sit there for 7 or 8 hours a day calling up people asking for $2,700. Yep. And they tell you, the DCCC or the DSCC or whatever, they tell you, or NCC, they tell you if you don't do that all day your first 2 years, you will not have a second term.
Yeah.
I knew a guy, and we, you know, he's a staff guy for me for a while, a producer. His job was to ride a little van from that place for the Democrats over to the House floor when they voted. So, in other words, they spend their whole time raising money, and then they, for 10 minutes, they take a break to actually vote based upon what? They didn't do any homework because they're on the phone all the time raising money. They don't know. They do see what the party whips tell them to do. So all you do is become like a sort of like a robot whose job it is to talk on the phone and raise money, be a telemarketer, constantly raising money, and then taking breakdown into be a U.S. congressperson.
Yeah.
It is a rotten business. I mean, everybody wants it. Nobody wants to give it up. They love the prestige. And I would like to be a congressman. But I know what that is. It's fundraising. Constantly.
Yeah, it is constantly.
And then it influences your thinking because very few people are ruthless enough, like Phil Burton of California, that, you know, he said, if you can't take their booze, drink their booze and vote against them in the morning, you don't belong in this place. But that takes a lot to vote against the person who just gave you $2,700. Oh my God. It's, I don't want to disabuse people of their love of our country, but that part of it, the money is awful.
It is a main driver, and it's definitional for everything, including policy and the character of the individuals involved. So it does. I mean, I've been in that room and know it well. And you know, a lot of us don't like it. But it's particularly when you're starting out, like they said, if you don't do it, you don't get another term. And so you're already boxed into this mindset. you gotta go spend 8 hours of your day on the phone raising money and then vote on something that you've never even seen.
I know. How about the guys and women who have these jobs as members of Congress, freshmen usually, and they fake it because they can't physically do it anymore. They're talking to the busy signal because they don't want their call time manager sitting next to them to know they're taking a mental break from
this. That's right.
And they're feeding you bad food too. They feed you like all this, you know, this stuff.
Well, you know, in the old day, that damn busy signal was loud as hell. So you're sitting there with the phone cupped to your ear as close as possible so that no one can hear you. Beep, beep, beep. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're having a lot of fun with my buddy Chris Matthews. His new book is out this month. It's entitled This Country, My Life in Politics and History. It's a high recommend for sure. And we're going to have more conversation with Chris about this country and a lot more right after this.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele Podcast. We're having a blast with my buddy Chris Matthews of Hardball fame and talking about his new book, This Country, My Life in Politics and History. It's out this month, so make sure you pick it up when it hits Amazon and your local bookshelf. So Chris, what's your assessment right now of, as you're looking at, put your little hardball crystal ball on, looking at the landscape of the political body? You referenced earlier that the Republicans believe, and, you know, they may be right to some extent, that 2022 is theirs to own. How do you?
I want to answer that question as part of the question you asked before, because about what the book's about. And this is what I think I came to in the last page of the book. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of doing this in an iterative process. I'm writing it, thinking about it. What the hell's this book about? And I think I came to it here. I talk about being an African in the Peace Corps. And then I go, I have another trip in mind, one I'll never take, but forever hope for. I imagine coming back to this country a few hundred years from now and finding it's still what our founders bequeathed to us. It will hold elections every 2 years for Congress, every four for president. There will be more equality, a greater comity. People will be happier with one another. Race and ethnicity will no longer stand as barriers to shared freedom and equality. Anyway, that's sort of what I want about America. But basically what we started with and improved upon in terms of people being treated fairly to each other. And I know I'm afraid we risk now. I look at the transition, the progression rather, You know that phrase on the top of the National Archives, what's past is prologue.
Mm-hmm.
But what's this a prologue to, what we're living through now? Our president rejects an election like we're in some third world developing country with no history of democracy. And the losing side claims they were robbed. Well, they do it all the time in some countries. Or that they get elected, they arrest everybody.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and then we had the insurrection because of the last president's denial of losing. And then we had two-thirds of the Republican Party, or 70%, Mark Paul, saying they didn't lose. And then we have a general saying there should be a military coup. Well, these are, you put all those ingredients together and say, where's this taking us? Now, maybe we'll get over this hurdle. Maybe this is cyclical. Maybe it's just one person. But the willingness of a two-thirds of a political party, a historic party, one of our two great parties, being willing to accept the dictate of somebody who says something which is profoundly wrong. We know who won the election by 7 million votes. We just
right.
It wasn't a squeaker. And I go back to people like Dick Nixon and Kennedy. If anybody had an excuse to question an election, it was Dick Nixon. He lost. He had 33 million votes. The other guy had 33 million votes. He lost because what happened in Chicago, and there's big questions about how good that election was in terms of accuracy.
Yeah,
he lost
yeah,
the
exactly.
election in Texas, and no, everybody knows LBJ was capable of anything. And they didn't even have poll watchers because there was no Republican Party back then.
Right.
And by the way, they burned all the ballots in Chicago right away. There was not going to be a recount. And you know, so Nixon has to, he'd been vice president for 8 years. He loses an election and he has to say yes. And he did. He not only did put out a statement the next morning, he said, I'd lost. He said, the night of the election, he said, if this keeps continuing trend, I'm the other guy's president. And then he sat down with Kennedy down in Key Biscayne, Florida, and basically handed over his sword.
Yeah.
I mean, he made it very clear who'd won. And he could have complained forever, but he didn't want to disrupt the country during the Cold War. He didn't want to have this interregnum that basically jeopardized the country. It's terrible that we've gotten to a point where we don't all, including the former president of Trump, feel that absolute call from on us to be good patriots.
So picking up on that point, which because you anticipated a question I wanted to ask you about, you know, what do you think the country will look like in 200 years? You come back and what do you see? So when you look at where we are, and we were talking before, and you actually asked the question, you know, what is this a prologue to? You know,
yeah.
What? How does the country recover from this? If this is a one-off, maybe that recovery is a little bit easier, but is it? And what? How do you think the American people are taking in the last 5 years, and especially taking in what happened on January 6th and processing that? Because that, to me, will answer the question: what is this a prologue to? Because if they want it to be a prologue to a better America that still holds onto those democratic principles, that's going to be very different from the course that it's on seemingly right now.
And that's a great question. A lot of the Trumpian anger and fear is about demographic change, just is immigration mainly from below our southern border, Hispanics. A lot, most of it's that fear in these small towns that things are changing.
Right.
The country's changing. I think some of it also comes from the intellectual and, intellectual academic elitism of a lot of Democratic leaders.
Mm-hmm.
They're snotty. They look down their noses at the working people. They call them deplorables, the whole.
Right.
Just that they think they're better than the people they voted for 100 years. The union people who work with their hands. I think those people really feel, rightfully or wrongly, we could argue that minorities have had a lot tougher in this country than a white guy working in Erie, Pennsylvania or Wilkesboro, but they feel discarded. A friend of mine from Pittsburgh was in the Peace Corps with me, said just about human nature, people don't mind being used, but they mind being discarded.
Interesting.
And these people, whatever you think of them, they're not angels by any stretch of the imagination. There's a lot of racism there, but a lot of those working people that switched for the Democratic Party in the last couple turns, they went to Reagan first, then to Trump. They feel discarded by the highly educated Democratic people, the big shots. They talk with a certain accent. They have a certain manner that suggests superiority. they look dismissive of people, even the parents they came from. They use that academic inflection. Right, you know what's going on.
Yeah.
I remember when I was a cop on the Hill, a guy I worked with, a building engineer, a super, the guy that fixed things in the middle of the night. When the light bulbs go out, he comes and puts a new light bulb in, that kind of thing. And he said, the only one of the Democratic liberal senators, all the big ones like Ribicoff and the rest, he said, the only one that said hello to the cops was Bobby Kennedy. And he would watch them.
Yeah.
And Bobby, yeah. Bobby could be a tough character, a ruthless guy, but he was not, he didn't have a sense of superiority. He didn't act like that. He liked cops. He liked, he identified with them and firefighters and people like that. He didn't have, and he was great on, obviously, on civil rights later on when he got there. But I don't know. I mean, some of it's resistance to Hillary at one point, resistance to, but the resistance to Obama, I think, was pretty much race. But Obama was so well educated and so successful in life. I think they just dismayed them. They said, how could this guy be so successful? So Sinatra cool about it too.
Well, to be rather blunt about it, there was a lot of the uppity Negro attitude that came along. That's what the whole birtherism piece, for me at least, as I saw it and experienced it, was about.
Right. Oh, by the way, there's Mike, I'm jumping. That's exactly what he's doing in Arizona right now. Remember the thing he said was, there's a lot of interesting stuff we're coming up with down in Hawaii. You got interesting stuff by investigators.
Right.
Yes. All made up. There's no investigators. There's no interesting stuff. Why would a woman who's raising a kid with an African father in Hawaii race over to Kenya? She didn't have money. Race over to Kenya and then put out a birth announcements in Honolulu so that her kid who she names Barack Hussein Obama. What is this? Why would she name? She call him Jackie O'Malley or something?
Right, exactly. He'd be the blackest Irish kid on the block.
No, she would not, or give him a WASP name. Why would she call him Barack Hussein Obama? And why would she go over to Africa to have the kid that had already been divorced? I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. And so why do people buy it? Why? So
because they're racist, I think. In that case, I would buy that one. Or else they're willing to just follow the leader and say, whatever Trump says has got to be true because he's a billionaire. He's got this big building in New York. And, you know,
I mean, and that dovetails back into the whole, that whole victimhood mindset that seems to emerge.
We're getting screwed.
Yeah.
And I Trump played to that brilliantly. He's a troubadour of trouble.
When you look at your time and your examination of this country and the various roles that you've played in it and the rooms that you've been in, what would you identify as that period, that zenith, that moment where the idea of America clicks?
Ronald Reagan was shot and I found out later from a guy named Max Friedersdorf, who was head of congressional relations. And these are smart people, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Head of congressional relations for a president tend to be really very aware of what's going on, very savvy. They have to learn the personalities and the interests of the people and their private life, even. They can learn everything about the senators they got to deal with so they can move them.
Right.
He had to be the only guy in the room when Nancy Reagan, the first lady, and Jim Baker, the chief of staff, decided to let Tip O'Neill be the first guy in George Washington University Hospital to meet with the president, who was in very bad shape. Half his blood supply had been lost. He had the bullet had lodged very close to his heart. He was in much worse shape than anybody knew. And they kept that, which makes sense. But Tip goes in, and there's Reagan on a gurney. A guy who looked his full age, in his 70s, you know. He looked that age. And there's Tip, who's pushing 70. Goes in and kneels down next to him, according to an eyewitness. That guy, Max Friedersdorf, was there. They prayed the 23rd Psalm together. Tip kissed him on the forehead, and he left. I mean, this little sacramental moment.
Wow.
I thought that, to me, was America. And I also thought that scene, the last night Tip was speaker, his 10th year as speaker, nobody had a history of unbroken leadership like that. I go back into his private room on the east front of the Capitol, his back room. And there, sitting in a semicircle, is Bobby Byrd, Bob Dole, Bob Michael, the Republican leader of the House, Tom Foley, Jim Wright, leaders of both parties in both houses, the House and the Senate, just sitting there, like Jewish people say, sitting Shiva, just sitting there and savoring their history together.
You know,
it went on for hours. And this is before Tip went out and addressed the House floor in a special session. But it was like, it was sacramental. It was like they're like appreciating and honoring the fact that they'd all served together for the country all those years together. And I remember Bob Dole, who'd been a war veteran, he'd been injured badly in the war. He didn't have use of his arms really. And it's like John McCain had a life like that. And he went over to one of these coffee terrains. He had to pull down the whatever. And
he had to pump the coffee. Yeah.
Yeah. He had to bring it out. And he couldn't do it. He didn't have two hands to do it with. And he couldn't hold the saucer. So he asked me to help him. Boy, did that mean something to me. I mean, let me help him, because Bob Dole was a self-reliant guy. And I just remember that because I think, I don't know if that goes on anymore. I doubt it. They don't want to be seen with each other again. Their contributors wouldn't understand. Why are you friends?
Remember, I mean, hell, look
at what they got off publicly together. Tip O'Neill and Jerry Ford. They wanted to be seen together. You try to find a picture of the two party people from different parties being seen together in a social occasion. Any kind of occasion.
Hell, I mean, look look at the pictures we are getting today. We've got, you know, this crazed Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, running around and screaming in the mailbox of, you know, a congresswoman.
Assaulting AOC.
I mean, it's just.
I don't get her, but, you know, I'll say one thing about the Republican Party, which was really the conservative movement, the new movement in the 50s. The conservative movement in the country had been known to be anti-Semitic for years. And, they had been the John Birch Society, which was a whack job. That Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, was a communist. They did stuff like this. He's a communist. He and his brother. Bill Buckley just said, "Enough of that crap, if you will." He just said, "No more of that. We're not going to do that anymore." And he told the conservatives who were in his movement. He was head of National Review. He said, "No more of that." And he really had an impact in New York, especially when there's a lot of ethnic politics, obviously. And I said, "No more of that anti-Semitism. That's not part of our act anymore. Get rid of it. And no more, more of this crazy right-wing Eisenhower's a commie stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get rid of that."
Well,
and I think there's no way like that on Fox. There's no way like that on.
I was going to say, right. Today, you've got Tucker Carlson out there saying, "Do more of it. Nobody's let me show you how to do it."
Nobody's saying, you know, I have a voice here, and my voice says, "Stop that. It has nothing to do with what we're doing here." Yeah.
How do you, before I let you get out of here, what's the takeaway you want people to have when they read this country, when they read your story, My Life in Politics and History? What's the takeaway that you want them to get, not just about you, but about the country that they live in and how much they may be a part of that story as well?
Well, you know, I have some stories that I think will blow the minds of some people. I was lucky to be in the Peace Corps, lucky to have had the job I had, which was economic development, which was working with Swazi businessmen, guys in their 50s, and getting to know them. You know, I was speaking English, and most of them could speak pretty good English, at least enough to talk with me. And they treated me like a son. They were wonderful. And some of them did. And common humanity, you know, with a different culture, different continent, different language. And yet, when you're with them, you know, there's a fellow human being right here.
Right.
And he says to you, "Do you want a cold drink?" Even though he doesn't have a refrigerator. "Do you want a cold drink? Yeah, here's your warm orange Fanta."
Right. Oh, Fanta. Oh, my God.
I mean, it's hot out now. And I go, "These guys, I'm just a skinny kid from America. And who's this guy in his 20s out here all alone? They know what it's like." And I had a guy with their district commission said, "I know what it must be like, the adventure of coming over here." Here's a guy who understood our perspective. He said, "You got people coming over here. This must be very exciting for you, but you have to give up TV and movies and everything." And
right.
I didn't want it. And he seemed to sympathize, but also was envious. The common human experience, with a little effort, you can figure out the other person's perspective.
Yeah.
And they certainly did to us. And I think that's one of my messages in life. And when you go to the Berlin Wall and a young kid says, "I just want to say that what's freedom mean to me? To me, it means talking to you. I never couldn't do this 2 weeks ago." And the things we were taught in Catholic school and first grade about the Russians and communism and what matters in the world were true. And when it all comes around, you get to say, yeah, communism is wrong. Maybe socialism of a certain kind could be fine, but communism, that kind of socialism, is no damn good. It's just dictatorial, and people are treated as less than the state. The state's more important than the person, and that's what it's all about. And I love the fact that Bishop Tutu, when he got the vote, and I'm standing next to him, and he yells, yippee, and he was kidding, but I get the vote at 62 for the first time. And thanks to his friend Nelson Mandela. And I love the common human nature of our lives. And I think we have to think more about it and realize if you're on a desert island, you want somebody else to show up and you're not too particular about who it is. You know, Robinson Crusoe ends up with a soccer ball. Or Wilson, remember? I think he would have preferred a real Wilson.
Yeah, exactly. Oh my gosh. Well, the book is This Country, My Life in Politics and History. The author is the incredible Chris Matthews. Man, I just, again, just a great conversation with you. The rooms you've been in, the people you've worked for and worked with, the stories you get to tell, and the moments for 20 years every night you could talk to America. We especially missed that last part, and hopefully
I miss it too.
Hopefully we'll get to see it again. But until then, I encourage everyone to grab a copy of the book, This Country, and sit back and enjoy a piece of Americana through the eyes of a young man who's seen it all and done a lot of it. Chris, thank you so much for taking time.
Thank you, sir.
Does it for this episode, this conversation, my friends. Thank you so much for being a part of the Michael Steele podcast. Don't forget, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, wherever you get that podcast groove on. Do that download thing. Give us 5-star review. We love it when you do that. It makes us feel all yummy inside as well. Follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele. And until next time, you know, take care of yourself. Be well. Get vaccinated. Don't be stupid. All right. And we'll have a conversation next time. Take care.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.